from the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles. Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very good morning to you from High FM 101.9, wherever you are in the world. Great to be back, lots to talk about. And coming up, we're going to be talking to one of the world's most famous authors. He's sold over 10 million books. He's been translated into 48 different languages. And you know what his books are about? How is it possible that a book about a little Botswana detective in Habarone, Botswana, became one of the most famous female detectives in the world? I am, of course, talking about Alexander McCall Smith and his books, The Number One Ladies Detective Agency. I'm sure so many of you have read the books. As I say, over 10 million, including others, of Alexander's books sold, translated into 48 different languages. So I'm going to be talking to him a bit later on in the program. He is here in South Africa at the moment, and I'll be talking to him. So stay tuned. But first of all, at the weekend, I went to see the production of My Fair Lady at the Peter Tureen Theatre at Monte Cassino. Now, let me tell you, I saw the original version in London. I think it was 1966, the very first one. Maybe 50s, 60s, time flies when you're having fun. Then, of course, saw the, and that original production had Julie Andrews in it and Rex Harrison. And I don't know if you remember, there was a bit of a scandal when they cast the film. They passed Julie Andrews over, saying she wasn't beautiful enough, and they cast Audrey Hepburn instead. I'm sure many of you remember the movie My Fair Lady with Rex Harrison and Audrey Hepburn. And of course, they dubbed Audrey Hepburn because she couldn't sing. She may have been beautiful and a good actress, but she couldn't sing. And of course, the irony is that later on, Julie Andrews went to star in the stage production and the film production of The Sound of Music. Fate has a funny way of sort of coming round to itself. Anyway, the production in Johannesburg of My Fair Lady, I know it's been playing in Cape Town for quite a while, so you may have seen there. A stunning production, let me tell you. Absolutely stunning. It's got some of the people we know from South Africa theatre in it. Craig Abane, I'm sure you've seen him in so much stuff over the years. He's playing Professor Higgins. Mark Richardson, bringing the house down with I'm Getting Married in the Morning, as the Dustman father, Graham Hopkins, and Sandy Dlangalala, I hope I pronounce that right, Dlangalala, who is from the Cape Town Opera. Oh, the beautiful, beautiful singing voice. But a 23-year-old, practically unknown in the role of Eliza Doolittle, a girl from Durban called Leah Marie. She's 23 years old. She can dance, she can sing, she can play the piano, she can do ballet, she can do tap. She was absolutely astonishing as Eliza Doolittle. And she is twinning the role with Brittany Smith. Brittany Smith does it the night that Leah doesn't, who is also a soloist with the Cape Town opera. So I urge you to go and see the show. It's just what we need, something to cheer us up when there's a lot of gloom and doom around. Wonderful ensemble singing and dancing, gorgeous costumes. And of course, at the end, there must have been a 5-minute standing ovation. That was on Sunday night. I went to the opening night and ran into people like, oh, all kinds of people like Jeremy Maggs, Alex J, like Andre Hassing, all sorts of theatre and stage and media personalities. It was a packed, packed, packed house. So go up, take yourself off. It's on, I think, till the end of March. I'm just looking at my program here to see the dates. These programs are so big now, you have to go through pages and pages. I haven't found the close date, but it's certainly going on till March and it's open now. Take yourself, take the kids. There were lots of grannies and grandpas there with their kids and families. Lovely family show for everybody. And as I say, something to cheer us all up. Sometimes we need it, although I must say the sunshine is back in Johannesburg. And now can never please everybody. And now, of course, we're saying we need rain. We need rain again. But everywhere looking so beautiful. And you know, when I talk to travellers, when I'm travelling not only in sub-Saharan Africa, but when I'm travelling abroad, people are always saying Johannesburg. Oh, it's got this, you know, it's got this sort of bad name. What can you do in Johannesburg, they say. I say, but you can do so much. I tell people to go to the Constitution Court at Constitution Hill, and it sounds so dry and so dusty. It isn't. It's absolutely wonderful. You'll get a great guide to take you around. It was the former women's prison. It's got so much history. You can go to Origin Centre at Wits, where they have wonderful exhibitions, very kid friendly too. If you're looking for a place to take kids, just Google Origin Centre at Wits and you'll see what exhibitions are on. Lots of hands-on interactive stuff. You can go to the Apartheid Museum. You can go out to Rietvlei near Pretoria. I'm always amazed at how few people know about Rietvlei. It's a nature reserve, game reserve. I think they've only got one cheetah left now because they sent the cheetahs to bigger game reserves all over South Africa and beyond. Rhinos galore, birds galore, antelope galore. I'm thinking there's sisibe, there's eland, there's impala, there's springbok. Lovely place to go out and very affordable for a day's outing. You can leave your car at the different hides if you want. And also, there's a heritage house, an old heritage house that was an administrative centre of some kind that do really, really nice sort of on-the-go meals. You can get a toasted sandwich, a coffee, sit outside under the old trees, look at the birds. And right next door, a donkey sanctuary where they've got quite a few donkeys. Don't attempt to pat one on the nose as I did. You might just lose a whole bunch of fingers, which I didn't. And of course, then you can go out to Marapeng, the cradle of humankind. That's a gorgeous day's outing. You can go into the visitor centre, which takes you right back to the dawn of time. And again, is interactive. It's not dry or dusty like visitor centres and museums used to be. It's a great place to go. And you go in this mound, which is built like an ancient tumulus, and you go in the one end, and when you eventually come out the other, you've got plains in front of you full of grazing antelope, go into the restaurant, have a coffee, have a meal, and watch the game, the zebra, all kinds of stuff. You know, you're a lovely, lovely day out. And I think they've just opened, or they're about to open. If you're interested, Google Sterkfontein Caves, where, of course, Mrs. Pless, one of our original ancestors, was found. And again, very interactive. I read their website quite recently. You can actually watch the archaeologists, paleontologists at their dig. The kids can dig for stuff. Lovely, lovely place to go for a day's outing. Okay, well, I'm going to be telling you a bit later on about the books I've been reading. I've got some lovely books for you. So coming up is an interview with Alexander McCall Smith. I'm so looking forward to talking to him. I mean, he's also a professor of ethics. I think he has doctorates from something like 14 different universities. And of course, he helped set up the law department. He's professor of law at the University of Botswana in Gaborone. I'll be back in just a moment.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there. And now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. My guest this morning, and I know he will blush, expect he's probably heard it so many times he doesn't blush anymore. Probably one of the best loved authors in the world. He has millions of readers all over the world. He's written over 100 books on a very wide array of subjects, including the award-winning number one Ladies Detective Agency series set in Botswana. Also author of the Isabel Dalhousie novels and the world's longest running serial novel. That beats Dickens, I think, Alexander, 44 Scotland's Street. His books have been translated, listen to this, in 46 languages. He's also Professor Emeritus of Medical Law at the University of Edinburgh, and he holds honorary doctorates from 13 universities. Wow. Welcome, Alexander McCall Smith. And really, because of the number one Ladies Detective Agency series, I do feel I'm talking to a friend, and I'm sure people listening probably think that too. But I know you were born in Bulawayo, and I know you spent quite a bit of your early life in Africa, went off to graduate in Edinburgh, came back to the University of Botswana, actually helped set up their law school. Was it while you were in Botswana that the idea for the number one Ladies Detective Agency began to, I don't know what's the word, manifest, bubble, whatever the word is?
Yes, well, Kate, thank you very much for your kind words. It was actually when I was in Botswana many years ago, when I was working at the University of Botswana, that the idea occurred to me that I might one day write about a woman who lives in Botswana who starts a little business. But I never really thought very much about it. And I suppose over the years back in Scotland, the idea bubbled away, as you say, in my subconscious mind. And then one day I sat down and wrote what I thought was going to be a short story about a woman who sells the cattle left to her by her father, her late father, and starts this little business. I really thought it was going to be a short story, which just goes to show how wrong you can be about these things, because I'm just at the moment writing volume 26 in what turned out to be a very lengthy saga, a lengthy literary conversation with the set of characters and also with the country, because I found myself thinking a lot about Botswana, And so it has been going on for some time, and I hope that I'll be spared to write even more of that particular series.
Oh, so do I, and so do all your readers. I've just finished the last one, The Great Hippopotamus Hotel, but I'll come to that in a moment. Now, our wonderful heroine, Precious Ramotswe, she always shows humour and compassion and wisdom without ever being nerdy or whatever. So would your family say you were full of wisdom and compassion and good humour?
Well, that's extremely kind of you to say that. No, my family treat me as families treat any husband and father, just as a husband and a father. And I don't think that they have any illusions about me. I'm the same as anybody else. I have all sorts of faults, as we all
I
do.
don't.
So don't mix me up with Precious Ramotswe. Precious Ramotswe, obviously I know her quite well. She's one of my principal characters, but it's aspirational. If there's anything, any connection between us, in a sense, I suppose you would say it's Precious Ramotswe is what I would like to be if things were ideal, but I'm never going to be. Quite as good a person as Mara Matsui is.
Now, I mean, it is amazing. You must have been asked this millions of times. I mean, you write about a woman in quite a small part of what was then Habaronia. I mean, it's grown so much over the years now. But I mean, it's a very domestic, ordinary. It's not wham bam, thank you, man. It's not blood and gore and bells and whistles. They are the most simple, wonderful stories. How what is it? Can you work out what is it that has appealed to literally millions of readers?
Well, I think, Kate, that many of us, myself included, like reading about ordinary life, about day-to-day existence. I think many of us, we obviously occasionally like to be thrilled and excited in what we read, and we read about extreme events of various sorts. But there's a great deal to be said about ordinary life, about leading an ordinary life, doing ordinary things. And I think that if you can tell that story with the addition of some humor, people respond rather well to that. I think in the case of Precious Ramotswe, when I invented the character, I was wanting really to write about the sort of person I'd met in Botswana. I'd met people like that in Botswana, and one would meet many people like that in many other countries in the region. I think in South Africa you meet people who have those sort of qualities. There's a certain decency that one finds in many people whom you encounter in day-to-day life. I'm speaking to you while I'm in Cape Town in South Africa, and it's always a great pleasure for me to come from Scotland to be here or in Botswana, and to meet people who have what seems to me to be a very positive outlook on life. I know that there are problems. There are problems in every country, wherever you go. But there's a certain I struggle for words to describe it. I sometimes just say a certain decency. There's a kindness that you encounter in many people on your travels, and I wanted to say something about that, because the people who many people in other countries have a rather what I think is distorted view of sub-Saharan Africa. They look at problems. They hear about problems, and of course there are problems in many of the countries in question. But that's only part of the picture. The other part of the picture is a picture of people leading good lives, often in rather difficult circumstances, and doing so very, very well indeed. And I wanted to portray that. You can go to Botswana, just as you can come to South Africa, and you meet people like that. I met women like Mara Motswe in Botswana, very intuitive, hardworking, and with a great sense of humor. And I think that that probably lies behind the appeal of the character of Mara Motswe. It's kindness. Kindness is something that we intuitively respond very well to. And there's a lot of kindness in the world. There are a lot of problems, there's a lot of cruelty, there's a lot of confrontation, but there's an awful lot of that positive quality, which is good humor, kindness, and generosity of spirit.
I haven't heard that word decency used for so long. And that's a perfect word too. Decency. You don't hear that word very often nowadays. You don't hear people talking about a decent person. I'm showing my years now, a decent person. But decency is such a wonderful concept, and that's what they have. And you know, Alexander, also, sub-Saharan Africa, South Africa, I know some of the countries, it's such a friendly country. I've just finished updating a big guidebook to South Africa, and I put in the sort of introduction that when you greet a South African person, and in Botswana, you'd say the male or whatever, the greeting is, "Good morning, how are you?" Now, if I did that to a checking out assistant in Sainsbury's in Salisbury, I don't think I've got nothing again. I don't even know if there is a Sainsbury's in Salisbury. But you know what I mean? It's part, "Good morning, how are you?" It's part of the decency, friendliness thing.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with you, Kate. You're absolutely right. On the subject of decency, decency is something that we all recognize and we all like it. We shouldn't be ashamed to use the word decency. I know that it's an old-fashioned word, but let's use these old-fashioned words when they do an important job. And decency does a very important job. It's a quality that we recognize, that we like, and my goodness, the world is in need of it. We need decency. The other day, I watched short excerpts from the late President Carter's funeral, and it was very interesting listening to what people said about him and just watching proceedings and realizing that he was, I think, a decent man. He came across as being very decent. Now, you could say, well, decency doesn't really define anything. Maybe it's hard to define exactly what we mean when we said, but my goodness, we know what it means, and we know that there are certain people who actually merit that particular description. And President Carter, I think, was
And
one.
also, I think we recognize it in people. We actually recognize a decent person. We
We
just do.
do recognize decency. The other thing that we recognize is graciousness. And graciousness is a quality which is fairly similar to decency. And I always remember many years ago, I think after the late Queen, Queen Elizabeth, had met President Mandela, she described him as that most gracious of men, which was a really interesting thing, a lovely compliment, because he had, I think, that graciousness. And graciousness is a quality that one sees. And if you look about the world today and you look at the sheer nastiness of much that's going on, of people snarling at one another, of people confronting one another, it seems that many of the values that we really appreciate, such as decency or graciousness, are in short supply. Look at the social media, where people take great pleasure in humiliating other people, in criticizing them, in sneering at them, all of which actually is very unpalatable.
Many years ago, too, I lived in Ireland for a while, and I remember an old Irish lady trying to give me something. And I was saying, no, I couldn't possibly take that. And she said, "It would be ungracious of you to refuse." And
Yes,
I talked to her,
very,
From that and the grandchildren, it would be ungracious of you to refuse. It's exactly what you're talking about. Now, Alexander, we have 26, and I want to talk about the other books too, Ladies Number One Detective Series. Do the ideas just come to you? Is it like an electric light bulb going off in the middle of the night, or is it something that sort of churns slowly?
No, it's the ideas come to me. They come to me pretty constantly. I have notebooks. I have a series of notebooks, and I write down these ideas as they occur, and they occur at all hours and in all circumstances. So I could be on an aeroplane or a train or something of that sort when an idea occurs to me that would suit one of the series of books, and not necessarily one that I'm writing at the time, and I write it down. So the ideas seem to flood in. I'm very conscious of my good fortune in that respect. I don't have to battle to work out what is going to go on in the books. And when I sit down to write the book, and this is another aspect of good fortune that I'm very grateful to, I don't actually really have to sit there and think what is going to happen in this chapter. What is he going to say to her? What are they going to do? What's going on in the background? It just flows. It comes from, I think, the subconscious mind. A lot of fiction, I think, is created by the subconscious mind, and then one acts as the medium for its expression. Now, obviously, one is inventing it somewhere in the recesses of the mind, but I find it's a very natural process for me, and I do tend to write rather quickly. It comes out at 1,000 words an hour, so I sit there and I write that, and I really don't. This isn't boasting. I'm just telling you how it happens. I don't actually really have to
You
think
write
about.
on the keyboard, or do you still write long?
Well, a bit of both. I principally write on a keyboard. I've grown accustomed to that. And I think once you make the transition from pen and ink to a keyboard, you develop a particular set of brain pathways which keeps you doing that sort of thing. But I also have notebooks, as I say, in which I will write sections of a page, for example, sections of a chapter. I write quite a lot of poetry. I've had two collections of poetry published. I write libretti for operas and so on. So there's quite a lot of poetry. And the poetry I always write longhand in the notebook and then transfer to the screen.
This is still sort of churning away, but I've used the word in my head about decency and graciousness. I mean, you were a professor of medical ethics, and that's really what your books, so many of your books are about, ethics. I mean, sounds so grandiose to say that when they're so warm and comfortable and inviting and wonderful to read, but medical, if we're talking ethics, we're talking good. I've just been looking at a book called The History of Good and Evil, and it's a book about my young professor at Utrecht University about the history of good and evil and how humans, not everybody would agree with this, but how humans have invented good and evil from, he claims, 5,000 years ago when it was possible. But all your books, all of them, whether it's Isabel Dalhousie, I must tell you, I love Ulf Varg. And Paul Smith, who of course is the author of the million best-selling number one ladies detective agency set in Botswana, has also written only not nearly enough books. He has a Swedish detective called Ulf Varg, who belongs in the department, oh yes, of sensitive crimes. And what I love about him, Alexander, is his deaf dog, Martin. Please, I want you to write more. And again, Ulf himself has so many of those same characteristics of graciousness and goodness. I mean, again, he's not a nerd. He gets himself into all sorts of trouble. But these qualities shine through so many of your characters. You're obviously a cockeyed optimist.
Yes, yeah, you're probably right. And Ulfarg is a character I like very much, and his dog. I often put dogs into my books. So Ulfarg has got this dog Martin, who's deaf, but who's actually the only dog in Sweden to be trained to lip read, which is a is a piece of nonsense. Although I did think for some time about whether it would be possible to train a dog to lip read. And you might be able to do it if you're dealing with an intelligent dog. They
Yes.
might just recognize, for example, that sheepdogs, I'm absolutely stand in admiration of sheepdogs, where shepherds can say, go left, go right, go round the back. And the dog understands all that. Dogs are pretty smart. Well, some of them. Some dogs aren't quite as smart at that. But dogs actually are really pretty smart creatures. So Martin is a favorite dog of mine in the 44 Scotland Street series, set in Edinburgh. There's a dog called Cyril, who's the only dog in Scotland to have a gold tooth. He's very proud of his gold tooth. And so the dogs are quite important characters because they observe human society. Look at a dog and look at the way they're looking at what's going on in amongst the people around them. They're trying to work it out, but they can't quite get it. Dogs can feel a little
No,
bit
right.
frustrated. They don't really
Just
get what's going on.
I can remember many moons ago being on top of a mountain in Peru, of all places, with a good friend who was actually a philosopher. And I'm looking at everybody sitting around minding their sheep or their llamas or whatever they are in Peru. And I said to my friend, "What are they thinking about?" And he said, "Absolutely nothing."
Yes.
Never forgotten that. Okay, so now you've got something in the pipeline, or you're about to work on something about Charles Darwin. Tell us about that, Alexander.
Well, I'm writing at the moment a play about Charles Darwin and the voyage of the Beagle, with my old friend and collaborator Nicholas Ellenbogen. Nicholas is a great dramatic figure in South Africa, has made a major contribution to South African theatre over the years. And Nicholas approached me. I was in Australia. I was on tour in Australia in December, and he said that he'd been asked to write a play about Darwin, which would be put on in the Cape when a tall ship, which is redoing Darwin's voyage of the Beagle, calls in at Simonstown. And would I care to write it with him? And I was rather tickled by the idea. So at very short notice, I said, yes, I do it. And we're working on that at the moment. And it's going very well. It'll be a play which really talks about Darwin's life and about obviously the voyage of the Beagle and some of the issues that he encountered on that, and then how he developed his great theory after his return. He was 5 years away from home on that little ship, including an important call in the Cape, and that's what we're doing. Darwin's a very interesting character, and of course he changed the way we looked at the world. Prior to that, people believed fairly firmly in creation, their cosmology, explained the world in terms of an act of creation of a supreme being. Now, Darwin, of course, he didn't go out and say that he was an atheist. So the idea of of natural selection is something which is perfectly compatible with a belief in God, for example. But he came under terrific attack, because there were many people who said, no, you're entirely wrong. The earth was created 4,000 years ago, whatever it was. And then there was a flood and the ark and so on. And Darwin was a bit bemused by this because it was so evident to him that there'd been transmutation of species, that the earth was constantly unsettled, that plates were moving, that mountains were emerging, and that the habitat of any living creatures on the earth had changed dramatically, and the creatures themselves had changed dramatically. So that became, after the publication of the book, very quickly that became the consensus. People realized that evolution must be the explanation of life on Earth. And although there was a rearguard action on the part of creationists, and there still are people who believe that there was a single act of creation, that all the species were created as they were, that we were created in our current form, that other animals, other species were created in their current form as well. So maybe the scientific battle isn't yet done. And of course, there are people who are wanting to roll back science. There are people who really would like to extinguish the Enlightenment that we experienced in the late 18th century, in which we've continued to live by. People who are anti-science, which is extraordinary and really very frightening.
We're running out of time. So fortunate. You're exactly how I imagined you to be. And I must tell listeners, because they can't see you, but Alexander McCall Smith is sitting at Nicholas Hellenbogen's house in the Cape, but there's a light behind his head, and he's got his silvery hair is all lit up by this light, and he looks as if he's got a halo. Exactly how I imagine the author of the number one ladies' detective series to be. Thank you so much, Alexander. And please write some more of our books. And please don't ever stop writing about Botswana and Gaborone and the wonderful characters there. Thanks so much.
Well, Kate, thank you very much indeed for our conversation. I enjoyed it so much. Thank you.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. Now, I want to talk to you about some of the books I've been reading. I'm sure many of you know the Irish author Anne Enright. That's Enrightg, Anne Enright. If you don't know her, go and get hold of any of her books, because if you're a serious reader, you're going to love them. What do I mean by being a serious reader? It means that she has wonderful characters. She tells a really good story in beautiful, beautiful language. You pick up some books. I picked up a popular female author recently. I thought I've got to give it a go. And it goes something like, and she had lovely dark brown hair and dancing blue eyes, and she was wearing a jacket. Awful, awful stuff. Who cares? Who cares? Anne Enright's characters will absorb you from the very moment. And they're nearly always, all her novels are about family. She's an Irish writer, as I say, born, and she lives in Dublin with her husband and two grown-up daughters, fairly grown-up daughters. And one of her very first books, if you've never read Anne Enright before, go to the one first that won the Man Booker Prize. It's called The Gathering. It won the Man Booker Prize a couple of years, a few years ago now. And it's about a family gathering, as the title suggests. And like all families, and if we've all got families, things aren't always as they seem. It all might look perfect and sunny on the surface. Meanwhile, people are fighting, there are hidden secrets. This one doesn't talk to that one. There's always somebody a bit strange in the whole family. There's a meme that goes around, if you don't know who the strange, funny one in your family is, it's probably you. So that's the gathering. And then every book she's written has won awards. She went on to another award-winning book called The Forgotten Waltz. The Forgotten Waltz. If you Google Anne Enright, you'll find all these titles. And one I particularly loved called Actress. That was the one before the most recent one I'm going to tell you about, Actress. Again, it's about a mother and daughter. And the actress is a very, very famous Irish actress. And it's about her and her daughter, and her daughter having to cope with not always being the centre of her mother's attention, being pushed to the sidelines, having to deal with her mother's fame from when she's very, very little. So beautiful, beautiful book again. But the most recent one, just published now by Random House, is called The Wren, The Wren. The Wren, for those of you who don't know, W-R-E-N, is the smallest of all English birds. It's tiny. If you're a birder in South Africa, think of a Prinia. It's even smaller than a Prinia, a tawny flank Prinia or a Barthoti Prinia. It's a tiny little bird, has a lovely little song, and its tail sticks up just like the Prinia's does, sticks up at almost a 90-degree angle to its little feathery body. And the book is called The Wren, The Wren. And again, it's about family. And this time, it's about a very famous, not ultra, ultra famous, like Seamus Heaney, and obviously a fictional poet, but a famous poet who abandons his family, leaving them behind in Ireland, and how the family, the wife is a single mother, and how she raises her child in the wake, as it were, of her husband's desertion. And she's done a very brave thing in this book. She's actually put some of the poet's poems. Don't worry, they're very short and very, very beautiful to read. Obviously one about the wren, the wren. And the daughter remembers her father, obviously a bit of a Dylan Thomas kind of creature, hard-drinking, womanizing, charismatic, charming, bit of a brute as well. But one of these men, one of these creative spirits that walk into a room and people fall down in front of his charm and his wits. But of course, beneath that lies another different man altogether. And he calls his daughter the wren. He describes her as a little wren, as a little bird. And a couple of the poems in the book, they're very short, 4 lines, 8-9 song, absolutely beautiful, about the Irish countryside, about his daughter, about love, about emotions. Really, really lovely book to read, The Wren. The Wren, as I say, published by Random House. And then another book I've just finished. It's by a Japanese author, and I must tell you, I hadn't heard of her. She wrote a best-selling book called The Kitchen. Her name is, a bit of an unfortunate name, her name is Banana Yoshimoto. Not quite sure how she came by the name of Banana, but she's a prize-winning and internationally best-selling author, including the one she won lots of prizes for, Kitchen. And her work has actually been translated and published in over 30 countries. And I'm just amazed that I've never come to her before. And this book is called Dead End Memories. dead-end memories. And in a way, it's also like Anne Enright, because it's about relationships, it's about people, and in particular, it's about women. And there are stories. The stories in the book, Dead End Memories, follow five women who, after very sudden and very painful events, just try to find some sort of comfort in everyday life. So, for example, you've got the daughter of a restaurant owner. She goes through a budding romance. Another woman has a near-death experience and suddenly starts a new life afterwards. Another woman goes and lives in her uncle's apartment after her fiancé betrays us. So they may be about women of a different culture, but the experiences are all about experience we've probably all known in some way or other, either through our own lives or through other people. So that's called Dead End Memories, and it's published by Faber and Faber. And in this country, the publisher is Jonathan Ball. So, and just to conclude, if you love Kathy Reich, she writes the thrillers, always with the word bones in the title. And there's a best-selling TV series with bones. Kathy Reich, that's Reichs. She writes detective novels with a difference, because her protagonist is a forensic pathologist in Canada who heads up a department of forensic pathology, not only in Quebec, but also down, I think it's in North Carolina, one of the Carolinas. Anyway, Kathy Reich's new book is called Fire and Bones. And it's good, not light-hearted, but it's good. What's the word I want? It'll keep her attention for an hour or two. Bit better than just airport reading, but it's not going to tax your intellectual capabilities too much, shall we say. So there we go. That's all the books for the week. Travel safely, look after yourselves, and of course, look after others too. And thanks always to our wonderful technical director, Lucy Masinga, and producer, Senna Pabetsi. I'll be back next week.